Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to the Following On podcast. I'm John Norman, and today bringing you a special feature we did during the interval in England's 66-run defeat to India in the first one-day international. Jarrod Kimber joined by the England international Kate Cross to discuss the rise of the women's game, how it's changed over the years, and really how it compares in both England and Australia. For more content like this, make sure you subscribe to the Following On podcast, available now via the free TalkSport app or wherever you get your podcasts. But for now, let's bring you Following On with Jarrod Kimber and the England international Kate Cross.
I've got an international cricketer with me, Kate Cross. You played this year against New Zealand. Took 1 for 40 in your last game. How'd you go?
In that particular game?
Yeah.
Yeah, to be honest, I thought I had a decent series. When you say I got 1 for 40, I don't think it sounds that great. But to be honest, just pleased to be playing again. We've obviously had quite a lean 12 months, like a lot of international cricketers have had or not had. So yeah, it was just good to get out into a COVID-free country and play some cricket.
We're going to talk about professional women's cricket, which is actually something that I've been quite obsessed with over the last couple of years because it's changed so much as anything. But I'm going to give you a slight history lesson, and I ran this by you before play, so I know you don't know much about this. In 1890, so you were only about 15 at the time, the original English lady cricketers was a cricket league in England where there were two teams that were playing. They played for crowds of between 15 and 20,000 people at times, which is incredible. The ad in the paper to get them to play, you'll like this, says, the women need to be of good address and appearance, respectable, strong, active, not under 5'6" in height, and not over 22 years in age.
It's funny because my ECB contract says that.
And what the brilliant thing is, it also at no stage in this ad mentions at all that they need to be any good at cricket or even interested in cricket. So it sounds like it was a very popular tournament for a very small period of time. So that was 1890. And then the next time there were professional women cricketers was your contract. So was that 2014?
2014, yeah. I think it was May of that year that we became professional, which was obviously a real landmark moment for the women's game. Yeah, and did not know that they were professional back in the 1890s. Didn't even know cricket existed back then, certainly for the women. But yeah, it just goes to show, doesn't it? There's a lot of history, and hopefully we're a big part of that history now. And maybe, you never know, people might be talking about us in 200 years' time.
Well, that's the thing with cricket. You can always find some odd, old historical fact when you talk about these things. But I suppose you started playing when you were still an amateur. So did you start playing in 2013, was it?
So I made my debut in 2013, yeah, debut for England. But I've been playing cricket all my life. You know, I'm a product of having two older siblings and being told what to do and what not to do in the garden. And I've got an older brother that batted and batted and batted all summer, and I had to bowl at him. So that's how I learnt my craft. A lot like a lot of my generation, really, you know, just being in the back garden and then going down to your local cricket club. But yeah, I think I made my Lancashire debut when I was 13 for the senior team, which goes to show how kind of amateur it was back then. I wasn't that good, so yeah, that's how amateur it was.
And you know, at that point, how when you say it was that amateur, what was the difference between, you know, 2013 and 2014? What was the huge change that you guys saw?
It was just the investment that we got from the ECB. You know, we got a salary, which was the first time ever that, well, other than the 1800s, that women were being paid to play cricket. And it meant that we could focus purely on cricket. It probably wasn't for another 2 or 3 years that we could fully focus and be, you know, full, what I would call full-time professional. We still kind of subsidised our wage by working with Chance to Shine, which is a big charity linked to the ECB. And we go into schools and coach and try and give a bit back, really. But yeah, there was, I think one of the biggest differences that I saw was the expectation level that came with being a professional cricketer. And suddenly the press rightly gave us more scrutiny and more coverage, which is what we want. But with that, there was this expectation that we were going to win all our games. And we actually lost a test match to India that summer, and it was a big talking point. Oh, it might have been 2015 we played that test match, actually. But yeah, it was just kind of that scrutiny that came with the press that was one of the biggest changes as well.
I remember in 2016, I think Mark Robinson was the coach at the time. You lost was it World Cup final against the West Indies, or was it semi-final? I'm trying to remember. I know I was at the game, but I can't remember which one it was.
I think it was the semi-final. I think we should have made it to the final, and we kind of lost that game. And that was, yeah, that was, I wasn't there actually. That was in India.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that was there was a big dressing room chat at the end of that, and it was kind of that point where things needed to change. And that was where Mark Robinson was absolutely fantastic for our setup, because he'd come from the professional men's game and was able to implement a lot of the things that happen and have happened for years in the men's game into the women's game, which is kind of what we lacked. We were that professional status without the real professional environment.
Yeah, I think that was, as someone who was following it from the outside, that was the first time that it seemed there was a real accountability. Beforehand, it was, everyone felt so amateur, and they would disappear, you know, off into their jobs. And that was the point where everyone was like, no, okay, you are being paid and you are at this level. Now, when we talk about professional, we're not saying that suddenly 200 women were given professional contracts. It was a small group, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was 18 initially, which kind of has fluctuated over the years. So I think last year we might have had 21 contracted. This year, with the regional contracts coming in, there's 40 new professional domestic players that are contracted and professional cricketers. So that's, I think then our contracts are getting renewed in about a month's time, actually. So I don't know the numbers, but I think it'll be closer to 15 or 16 now that would be your central contracted England players.
And following that, Australia did a similar thing. And then there was a few other things that happened around the women's game. The Indian women started getting a lot more jobs by being cricketers, which are jobs that used to go to the men's cricketers. They used to have jobs with the railways and with places like that. The Sri Lankan team took a huge jump up. They went from nowhere. I think they beat England in one of the World Cups there. And their players were with the armed forces. And now it's got to such a point where the Brazilian women's team are the first team to be professional before the men. The Thai players, I'm pretty sure they have some professional players on their books. So women's cricket has gone from, in the last 8 years, from almost having no professionals all the way through to places as random as Thailand and Brazil having it. So it's a huge pump of money that's come in, even if it's still not as many women as we'd like covered.
Yeah, and rightly so. I mean, obviously I'm going to say that I'm involved in it, but...
You would like more money, is what you say.
I'd like more female professional cricketers, is what I'm saying. Don't put words in my mouth, Jared. But no, I think we're in a real weird transition phase where not everyone is fully professional, and the level of professionalism that we've got and the investment that we've got varies from country to country. So I think you're kind of seeing a real jump from each nation. There's no real argument that Australia kind of lead in the pack with that, and we've kind of always said we're maybe 4 or 5 years behind them in terms of how they've professionalised their domestic structure. Obviously we saw with the at the back end of last year that the ECB have committed to contracting some of our domestic girls as well. But yeah, I think that for me now you've got another 5 years of a real transition period where you're going to get more investment, which needs to happen, more global tournaments. You know, the way that we have our Ashes series, I think, is a real positive step forward, and I think a lot of other nations should take that on. Whether they will do, I don't know, but for anyone that doesn't know, we play 3 one-dayers, a test match, and 3 T20s, and it's a point system, and you get an overall winner at the end of that. So yeah, our Ashes is a little bit different, but I think that's just a really good way of keeping people involved throughout a series, and hopefully, like I said, if more nations could jump on the back of that and use that system, I think it'd be quite positive.
And so let's talk about the Australian women's system. So they have gone, we're talking about the Indian men's team, but the Australian women are probably even more dominant now than the Indian men have been over the last few years, and maybe even will be. And the big change really comes from, it's not the professionalism in the international level, which is really handy. It's the professionalism for the domestic level. And with the implementation of the Women's Big Bash, you suddenly had, you know, young girls coming through at 14, 15, 16, seeing it as a profession, being even if it was only a part-time wage, because a lot of their Women's Big Bash players in Australia, a lot of them seem to work in, with car parts. I don't know why so many Australian domestic women work in car parts.
Sammy Jo Johnson, you're thinking of her, aren't you?
I looked at Jess Cameron as well, also works with car parts. So I'm just saying, there's a lot of part-time work there. But the difference is, that's a huge step up from before, where you, especially if you think about the England women, you had professional and then you had amateur still. It's very hard to break into a professional setup if you're going up against a woman who is spending 40 hours a week making herself the best athlete you can be, and you're working in a bank and going to the gym a couple of hours a night.
Yeah, arguably, if you're in that that phase of being a career where you're not quite professional, but you're trying to be professional, you've got to work twice as hard as the person that is getting paid to do the job you want to do. So a bit of a catch 22. I think the biggest thing for the Aussies, like I said, they probably started that investment a few years prior to what we did in terms of the domestic structure. I think, like you said, we kind of turned professional around the same era. But I think what we found difficult over here is that naturally the way that you've got your states over in Australia, it naturally lends itself to being able to have those teams, whereas we've had, it's the same with the men's structure, I think. The fact that there's 30-odd counties systems who are trying to survive in this game, and then you take away the amount of females that play cricket, you know, we naturally have less female cricketers involved in the game than the men do. That's quite a hard structure to do. So I think the ECB, the way they've done our new domestic structure, is brilliant. I think it feeds into the 100 teams as well, which is going to be really important for us as players. But I mean, I've completely forgotten the question that you asked me then. I've just gone off on a tangent, sorry.
No, I mean what we're talking about there is the Women's Big Bash has six teams. Sorry, eight teams, isn't it? It has it city-based. It's easier to do where you've still got really strong women's minor county sides over here. Like it's a really, you know, it's a much more spread out system than you have in Australia. But the difference was in Australia, they weren't just seeing themselves as competing against England or the Indian women. They were seeing themselves as competing against Aussie rules football, which had a professional competition coming in. Even someone like Elise Perry, I think Australia was very lucky to keep her as a cricketer because she was arguably as good at football. She kicked the goal of a World Cup final. You got Susie Bates in New Zealand, who represents the New Zealand women's basketball team. She could have easily gone to the WNBA in another era. You're really competing with the other sports for the best athletes, and I think that's what you want to see in the UK, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we quite quickly, when we signed our ECB contracts, we were told we weren't playing any other sports. I think naturally, from an injury point of view, you're going to do that. But
you were just about to go to Wimbledon too, weren't you?
It was netball for me. Loved my netball. No, never tennis. I'm absolutely wretched at tennis. But yeah, I think what you were talking about, I mean, I went over and played in the WNCL in Australia, which for anyone that doesn't know is the 50-over domestic competition over there. And that was probably 4 or 5 years ago. Another big thing that happened with Australia, which you'll be able to talk about in more detail than me, but the MOU that happened with the Australian men and the Australian women, and there was a real push on the men's side to support the women and to... I talk about this a lot, but having the opportunities that men have, I'm not talking about wage or money or anything here, but the opportunities that men get within cricket is far greater than the ones that the women got, whether that was professional or non-professional. And so I went over there and it was a case of I wasn't paid as an overseas amateur at that point, but I was getting match fees, and it was the same as what Glenn Maxwell might get if he played for Victoria, for example. So there was just those subtle differences that came in that was a real... probably the backbone of how the women's game then became more supported. You'll be able to go through the dates and stuff of when that kind of happened, but that kind of felt like the slingshot almost of then the success of the Australian women's team that we see now.
Yeah, that was 2017, and it was really interesting at times. Because there was a strike and there was all these talks. There was actually the Cricket Australia tried to split up the men and the women to sort of play them off against each other a little bit. And then there was a story about maternity rights and all these things that you don't think about. There's a really good book called The Fire Burns Blue about the Indian women's team that came out a couple of years ago. And it talks about the sorts of things that the Indian women cricketers had to go through without any, proper professional structure. Like one woman got pregnant and put on 20 kilograms during the pregnancy, but didn't have access to a gym because the gym was shut when she was free at the local ground, and didn't have access to a dietitian because he only worked with the men's team. Little things like that. And that was one of the things that the Australian men and women's cricketers sort of said, this is not how a normal workplace should go. It's really quite interesting. When we talk about amateurs, I just want to get back to the sort of schedules that an amateur or even a part-time woman cricketer would have to do at the sort of domestic level. There's a woman in India called Neha Tanwar, and it's in that same book I was talking about. She wakes up at 4:30 in the morning to cook breakfast and lunch for her family for the day. She then has to go off to work in Delhi. Then from there, she has to go to training in the afternoon. She gets back home at 8:30 p.m. That's what she has to do to be a part-time cricketer. It's still not, and we were talking about before, Sammy Joe Johnson and Jess Cameron, they still have jobs. Alex Hartley was looking at getting a job recently. Was pizza delivery driver, I think she told me at one stage she was looking at. Might have been pulling my leg. But essentially, it is still tough at the semi-professional level for those women coming through, the domestic women, even when they have contracts, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And as an athlete, you want to dedicate your time to being an athlete. You wouldn't expect someone like a Ben Stokes to be working from 9 till 12, then going doing his training sessions and fitting his gym and going picking the kids up from school. So it's hard to expect women to do that as well and create the standard that we expect from professional sport. But that's where these contracts are brilliant, and that's where you just kind of want to push the global tournaments to allow the teams like Thailand, who did come in the T20 World Cup that we had last year, and they perform well for a team that hasn't been professional that long, if they are fully professional, if you can deem them that. And that was great for us to see as an England team, to see that kind of structure is happening around the world as well.
You said you started when you were 13. Quick answer on this. Are you, as a 13-year-old, and now you're obviously just 15 now, looking back, can you believe the difference in women's cricket?
No, absolutely not. And I probably can't keep this as short as you want it to be. But when I was a kid, females weren't professional cricketers. I went to uni, I went to school, I worked hard, and I tried to balance cricket because it was just my passion. I loved playing it. I was so lucky and so fortunate that I came out of university and the contracts became available. But then you've got the likes of a Sophie Eccleston, who's come out of school and signed a first professional contract. So girls aren't... you're going to see a generation of girls now who can commit to it completely. And those domestic contracts that we spoke about, like an Alex Hartley, who's lost her England contract, can then drip feed back into the domestic system and also be a role model for younger girls who aren't quite there yet.
You've been listening to a chat between Jarrod Kimber and the England international Kate Cross, discussing the rise of the women's game and how it's changed over the years. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back on the free TalkSport app, available on all good app providers. But a reminder, we will be back on Friday morning for live and exclusive ball-by-ball commentary of the second ODI between India and England, here on TalkSport 2, on air at 7:30, and an 8 a.m. start in terms of play. You've been listening to the Following On podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.